This is Tell Me More, the Sunday magazine on 101.1 More FM, WBEB Philadelphia. I'm Emily Scheibert. Good morning. This week, understanding how obsessive-compulsive disorder and autism can be connected. Dr. Martin Franklin of Rogers Behavioral Health Philadelphia will be here in this edition of Tell Me More. Current estimates suggest that 1 in 100 children has OCD, which means that millions of children worldwide are suffering from this disorder. When you include parents, other family members, friends, and school personnel affected by a child with OCD, this unwanted condition has an impact on many millions more. Autism spectrum disorder refers to a group of complex neurodevelopment disorders characterized by repetitive and characteristic patterns of behavior and difficulties with social communication and interaction. ASD occurs in every racial and ethnic group and across all socioeconomic levels. However, boys are significantly more likely to develop ASD than girls. The latest analysis from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 1 in 68 children has ASD. More and more, mental health experts recognize that these two disorders can occur at the same time. The largest study of people with autism and obsessive-compulsive disorder to date adds to mounting evidence that the two conditions share genetic roots. Compared with their typical peers, people with autism are twice as likely to receive a diagnosis of OCD, and people with OCD are four times as likely to also have autism. Clearly, accurate diagnosis of mental health issues can be challenging, and finding appropriate treatment is particularly crucial. Dr. Martin Franklin, clinical director at Rogers Behavioral Health in Philadelphia, helps to sort it all out for families. Rogers has a wide variety of programs for kids and adults who have OCD and depression. There's also growing demand for their co-occurring autism programs, kids who have anxiety and depression in connection with autism. Franklin says they're getting somewhat better at diagnosing these conditions earlier. What is the challenge now in terms of diagnosing? Are we getting better at putting people in the category they belong in? Because I think you see a lot of people and kids in particular who've been labeled as one thing, and then you discover in treatment, oops, this is not what they have.
Sure. I think we've become more sophisticated at picking up on what we call internalizing disorders, so anxiety, depression, et cetera. And I also think that there's been some real advance in the last decade or so in recognizing the symptoms of autism, even in kids who are fairly high functioning, sometimes even mainstreamed in school. And over the last 10 years, we've become better at diagnosing all of those. And one thing we've noted in research that's been done both in Philadelphia and around the country and around the world is a lot of kids who have primary diagnosis of autism also have anxiety and depression that isn't really part of their autism. It's a secondary diagnosis. And sometimes the secondary diagnosis can be driving a lot of functional impairment for families and for the kid. So we're getting better at seeing them all together as well.
Describe what a child would be like who might have these two co-occurring disorders going on at the same time.
Sure.
What would that kid's behavior be like?
Well, I think in the context of their autism, they would likely have a lot of difficulty with social and emotional communication. Reading the subtleties of social interaction is really difficult for these kids. Identifying and understanding emotion is also a big problem. And then on top of that, so that's sort of the core deficit, and you've got inflexibility and desire for sameness and rigidity of thinking. But on top of that, you can also have a comorbid anxiety or depressive symptomatology. And so in those kids, here are kids who might – let's just say they're anxious about getting contaminated, so touching something that's germy, if you will. those kids already have difficulty with explaining and understanding emotion. And when they start to touch things, now they get fear. And they're probably not going to be very facile at understanding what's happening and being able to cope with it. And so those kids may be highly likely to avoid or to engage in contamination-related compulsions like hand washing or just avoiding altogether, which then makes it harder to move them through their day. If they have to go to school and they're worried about being germy, then they might then either not go into a classroom or not go near a particular student. And these are kids who are quite rigid and quite inflexible, so it's difficult to coax them in. And then because they're not confronting the thing that makes them afraid, those fears are going to get worse. So when you avoid or when you ritualize in response to a fear, that fear, you get temporary relief because you're not in touch with it. Having to be in touch with it, your fear is typically stronger.
There is a term, the autism spectrum, now. Explain what we mean by that, because autism is not really enough to describe what a kid might have. I mean, you have the one end of the spectrum where children are nonverbal.
That's right.
And then another end where you may have brilliant, articulate kids, mm-hmm. but it's still considered part of the same continuum.
Right.
Talk about the differences.
And I think certainly there are going to be differences along that continuum in terms of severity and the degree to which language has been compromised. There's also going to be some IQ differences. So a kid might be nonverbal but still be able to understand how the world functions and have some even savant-like attributes that they might have. But another place I think where you'll see it vary on that continuum is the degree to which the kid is either socially motivated or not. So there are many, many kids with autism who like to be alone, but it's not because they're anxious. It's because that's just their preference, and they want to do what they want to do, and it's difficult for them to understand the social world, so they avoid it. But along that continuum, you're going to have some kids who have social deficits but are socially motivated. And those are the kids that oftentimes will not understand why they're getting rejected, will not understand why talking about their focus interests is not helping them make friends or maintain friendships. And then those kids, because they're socially motivated, they're not having a lot of success in the social milieu, and they feel badly about it. And so those kids may well benefit from some social skills work where they can learn, because it doesn't come to them naturally because of the autism. They can learn how to navigate the social world more effectively, and that may help them be more successful and then hence reduce their discomfort and fear.
With a child that has ritualistic behavior, how do you distinguish between the OCD kids and the autistic kids?
That's a really good question. I would say it depends on the function of the behavior. So if I see a kid who, when he gets either upset or if he is happy, sometimes you see kids doing things like this flapping behavior. And
the
that,
hand
to me,
flapping.
The repetitive behavior there may well be a reflection of change in emotional state. And so it's almost like a reflection of them being either moved in one direction or the other. I would think that if they're hand flapping, it could be the same behavior. If they're hand flapping because they felt like there was some specific thing that was going to be prevented if they're hand flapping. For example, if I'm hand flapping because if I don't hand flap, something bad's going to happen to my mom, then to me that's not a symptom of autism. That is a symptom of OCD, because I have an intrusive or unwanted thought that I'm trying to get rid of or reduce the likelihood of it happening by doing this repetitive behavior. Hand washing certainly fits that description, but there are a lot of things along the line. I mean, I think sameness is a good example. So if I have a pack of papers like I have here, I might want them to be perfectly aligned and set them up in a way that makes me feel comfortable. And you could see that being an autistic attribute, but you can also see that being something that if the kid says, well, I'm not going to get an A in my test if I don't have the papers perfectly, that has more of a kind of a relation with an obsession, an unwanted or intrusive thought, and then the kid's doing this in order to increase the likelihood that they're successful. That sounds more sort of the if-then piece of that sounds more like an OCD problem. And so I would be looking to see when this comes up. I would be looking to see whether the kid finds it to be comforting or whether they don't really want to be doing it but they feel like they have to. That also will help me distinguish which of those two things it is. And by extension and treatment, it'll help me think about which ones of these things I want to target. So if I have a kid who just likes to sort of rub his hands when he gets excited and he does this thing and it doesn't bother him, it doesn't bother other people too much, I'm not likely to try to target that. If I've got a kid who's scraping off contamination because they're afraid they're going to get sick and they don't want to be doing that, but they're afraid they have to or else they're going to get sick, that's one I would target. So it may even look the same, but I'm really looking carefully at what's the function. Why is this kid doing this? And when you're talking about autism, oftentimes social and communication deficits will lead that to be a difficult thing to figure out. I can ask. The kids may say, I have no idea. I don't know. I just like to do it, or I just do it. And I like to do it versus I do it might tell me something right there. So we're also going to do a tremendous amount of observing. And we'll see the kid in multiple contexts. We'll see them with other kids. We'll see them with parents. And we'll be looking for these sorts of behaviors that may give us some clues as to which it is. And then by extension, whether we think it's just part of the autism, in which case we should sort of leave it be, versus we want to target it because we think we can reduce it if we can reduce the fear.
So is OCD considered a behavioral thing that develops over time in certain children for some reason, and autism something that people are born with, a congenital sort of thing?
Really interesting questions. I think for both conditions, there's probably not a lot of controversy about saying they all have their biological underpinnings. So they all have a sort of a home in the brain, if you will. I think the recent work in autism suggests earlier and earlier eye contact deficits, things like that, we can catch it in infants. In OCD, I would say that that's probably not the case. Much more likely you're going to see that later on. The average person's OCD onset is probably going to be in childhood or adolescence, and they may have had some tendencies in those directions, some tendencies towards worry or repetitive behavior. But then at a certain point, it becomes a constellation of things that are getting in the way, and then you come up with a diagnosis. But we certainly have seen little kids as young as age 4 or 5 who have legitimate OCD symptoms. And I would say autism, I might expect to see the vestiges of it, the beginning of it, in very young kids at this point. I think that we're getting better at understanding what sorts of things you might expect, what sort of things you might be looking for, eye contact and connection with other people, and self-stimulating behavior might be another thing that you'd see. Preference for sameness would be something I'd expect to see in a little kid with autism. I'd also say if they like to roll the truck and like to watch the wheels turning, and it seems like the wheel is the bigger deal than the truck. A lack of imaginative play, you'll see a little bit older, but those sorts of things collectively, and also sort of their preferences for and capacity with other kids, and even with adults. If they just don't seem like they're connecting in terms of their eye contact, their preferences, and their language is compromised, that makes me start to wonder. So I think OCD would probably be something you'd see later. But if you have somebody with autism, you're going to have to do a little bit of work to separate the two before you make assumptions about a repetitive behavior being a compulsion.
Because babies do some of that.
Exactly. Oh,
right?
Yeah. All the time. They do.
What do we know about the autistic brain? What do we know about what causes it? Can you see the mechanisms of autism in autopsy, or, do we know anything about that?
I'm going to pass on that a little bit. What I am going to say is that the folks at the Center for Autism Research, which is down at CHOP, are the kinds of people who've been studying that extensively, and they believe that they have some biological evidence for these differences very early on. They're doing really neat work on fMRI, looking at the brains of kids with autism and looking at kids who are sort of high vulnerability, so the sibling of a kid with autism, and looking over the course of time at changes in the brain. There's been some recent stuff that they've been talking about in terms of brain size, but I don't want to mischaracterize what they're doing. My sense is, as a behavioral psychologist, I'm interested in all that background, but what I'm really interested in is not so much etiology or onset. Why does a person have it? Because I think that's an incredibly complex biological learning theory, very complex story. I'm more interested in maintenance. So what is it about what's happening right now with these repetitive behaviors, with these things that drive fear? What is it that is maintaining either fear or discomfort, and how can we use behavioral principles to address that? And I think that there's certainly in OCD evidence that if you change behavior, you can change brain functioning and maybe even brain structure. But I'm a behavioral person who's going to be very interested in using those principles of learning theory. And sort of to be simplistic about it, if you are afraid of something and you avoid it, your fear will be maintained. If you're afraid of something and you gradually learn to confront it and tolerate it, it's in all likelihood you will be anxious when you're doing that. But with repetitive opportunity to learn, so doing it again and again and again and again, is you'll likely see that fear, maybe not eliminated, but reduced enough for you to function. And then you get positive reinforcement for functioning better in that context, and gradually that fear drops out. That's the concept.
In treating kids with OCD, are you looking at a behavioral approach in combination with medication?
I would say this. There are studies, including some that we've done over the last 15 years, in which you looked at the relative efficacy both in kids and adults, looking at cognitive behavioral interventions, essentially exposure, what we're talking about. So looking at exposure alone versus combined treatment, so exposure plus serotonin reuptake inhibitor, which are the medications of established efficacy for OCD. And in some studies, you see an advantage for combined treatment. In some studies, you see that both work quite well. But what I would say is in the clinic, there are a subset of kids who I feel like they may need combined treatment over CBT alone. And those are the kids, I think, whose OCD symptoms are really severe, and I'm going to have a difficult time getting them to engage. So if I have a kid who's washing his hands 50 times a day and is deeply committed to never touching things, and when I start to propose touching things, he says, there's no way I'm doing that. That might be a kid who I may want to medicate first, send them off to the psychopharmacologist, child psychiatrist to get them on a medication, which might lower the fear enough for them to do what needs to be done. It's rare to see somebody respond perfectly to a medication alone, but in combination with CBT, if I can just get them in a better place, that may be where we go. And in our program, I'd say probably at Rogers, the vast majority of the kids that we see, because we're running a partial hospitalization program and an intensive outpatient, most of the kids we see are going to have combined treatment. They're already going to be on a medicine before they get to us because they're more severe. The reason they're coming to this higher level of care is because they haven't responded as well to the lower levels of care. And most of the time, if I have somebody in CBT who hasn't responded to weekly CBT or twice weekly CBT for their anxiety, that's a kid I might add a medicine. And if that kid now is doing twice weekly CBT and medicine and he's still not moving, that may be a kid who winds up at a program like ours. And then I'd say probably the majority to the vast majority, both kids and adults that we see, are going to be on at least one medication when they get to us. And it shouldn't interfere with our CBT. It actually may enhance it.
And CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I got it right.
Excellent.
Explain, if you would, the experience of the person with OCD, especially a child. I think to some of us it seems quirky, like, oh, yeah, they like to line up their toys, or right, the fringe on the carpet has to be perfectly straight, or they, in films, we've seen people with OCD depicted, and it seems mildly amusing. Mm-hmm. But that's not the experience of having this compulsion.
No.
Can you talk about what that internal thing is like for them? It's quite painful.
Sure. And I think there are, again, it exists on a continuum. So there may be some people who just prefer things to be neat. And if they function beautifully and that just helps them and they're organized and good for them, they can find things when they need to. I don't even consider them to have anything like this. It's where it becomes so frequent and so anxiety-provoking and so impairing, where it crosses from being, like you said, sort of quirky and an unusual attribute to being a disorder, is where the functional impairment comes. And for a lot of these people, an example of a kid with OCD who is wondering if things are going to be okay. So they're a little bit worried, and so they turn to mom and they might say, so everything's going to be okay, right? And that sounds like a regular kid question. Mom says, yeah, we're good. And then for most kids who are a little bit worried about some circumstance or some situation, that's enough. For these kids, they'll say, you said things would be okay. You sure about that? And the mom's like, or the dad, yeah, things are going to be okay. So you're sure things are going to be okay? Things are going to be okay, right? 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 Things are going to be okay? And next thing you know, I'm going to have two things going on. I've got a kid who's getting reinforced for asking that question because the parents are answering it. And now I've got an argument going on as well because the kid's going to feel irritated. And as you can imagine, I could already see in your facial expression that if I continue that for another 40 minutes, you'd be irritated with me too. And so those kinds of things then lead to what we call accommodation. So the family tries, they move heaven and earth, they walk on eggshells, they try not to let the kid get quote-unquote triggered. But when the kid does get triggered, because life invariably you're gonna run into these things, now the kid gets triggered, now they're worried, they just saw something on the news that was scary to them, now they want to start this reassurance thing again. And now the kid's in this sort of cycle, and the parents are desperate to try to get them out of that so they can function like kids. So they give them reassurance, which provides temporary relief, which sounds like a good idea, except for one small problem. From the learning theory standpoint, I just made it more likely that the next time that happens, I'm gonna want to ask that question again. And now I'm on this treadmill that I can't seem to get off. And these kids, vast majority of kids with OCD presentations, they don't want to be doing this. This is not a hobby. They're not trying to upset their parents or their siblings or their teachers. They don't want to be doing it. They feel like they have to. And I think that's where it starts to spread out from sort of normative quirkiness.
And the just stop it. Just don't do that anymore. It's not normal. I mean, that is in no way going to work.
I would say this. I'd say there are ways in behavior therapy we try to encourage families to do exactly what you're describing, to reduce and ultimately eliminate the compulsions. But how you do that is really important. Because if I tell a kid, just stop it, don't you realize that's not normal? Everyone's looking at us. Now I just provided additional gas for the fire, as opposed to me saying, okay, so the doctor told us that we ought to try to reduce these questions at home. And you know you ask them a lot, and we're going to try to reduce it. Let's just say we have two. Like you have two when we're going to bed, because I know bedtime is a hard time for you. You can ask two questions today. I'll answer them quickly. You don't get a second answer, and we're together going to sort this out. And then when the kid does it, you say, good job. And if the kid says, well, just one more question, then you can say, well, remember what the doctor said. Remember what we're working on. For younger kids, you have a little sticker chart for, you know, reinforcing their effort. And then you come back to the doctor's office. In our case, it's going to be daily, and they're going to reinforce those efforts at home and provide the kid more opportunities for exposure practice during the day so they can get better and better and better at it. But there's a difference between, I think, what we'd expect in terms of compliance in our office or in our clinic as opposed to at home. It's going to be harder at home. They're more used to it. They're more used to people giving in. They're more used to being able to take a 45-minute shower. And we want to get them voluntarily. I love it when the kids say, well, therefore I shouldn't wash as much, right? If the kid understands what washing is doing and they understand how that's perpetuating their suffering rather than reducing it in the long run, then I want the kid to say, well, I guess we should work on that, huh? Yeah, exactly right. I want to get the kid to be engaged. I'm not just going to impose it on them. And I think that's another difference is if the kid is part of the team and the team has decided tonight we're going to try to reduce this. And or tonight we're going to try to reduce the shower length, or we're going to try to reduce checking. You're going to finish your homework and put it in an envelope instead of going over it eight times. Then the kid feels more agency. They're bought in. They come in the next day. They say, I put my homework in the book and I didn't look at it again. And we throw a ticker tape parade as therapists. Like, that's fantastic. Good for you. And kids like to be reinforced. And so everybody likes to be reinforced. And so we spend a lot of our time trying to move kids from where they are to where we need them to be, but we don't ask them to do it all at once, and we reward and reinforce them all the way.
Well, I know at Rogers, one of your specialties is identifying all these co-occurring things. Mm-hmm. But in hearing about the nuts and bolts of obsessive compulsive disorder and autism, I'm wondering how there isn't always a co-occurring anxiety or depression.
Yeah.
I can't imagine having any of those disorders without having sadness and worry that accompany the things that you've been describing.
Absolutely no question. And when you look at the literature, when you look at the studies that have carefully evaluated for anxiety and depression in the context of samples that have autism, what you'll find is almost exactly what you just said, which is the majority to the vast majority, depending on the study, are going to have a second co-occurring condition we call comorbid condition. And oftentimes that's going to – and it may also be externalizing things like attention deficit disorder and things like that. But anxiety and depression are maybe the most common co-occurring conditions in the context of autism. I think you're right. And I think the world is hard for these kids. It's hard for them to understand. It's hard for them to navigate. Sometimes they don't get the kind of reinforcement at school or on their teams that other kids do. They get isolated and they get for those kids who care about such things, and some do, that's really upsetting. And so you might expect to see secondarily some of these things occurring. And you might also see entirely separate diagnoses, panic disorder or generalized anxiety disorder occurring in the context of a kid who also happens to have autism. So we're going to try to get the kid to reduce and eliminate avoidance, whether it's compulsion in the form of OCD or just other forms of avoidance for other anxiety disorders, systematically climb what we call a hierarchy. So we kind of climb, do things that are a little bit challenging, get rewarded for that, move up again, move up further. We're going to try to get them to do all of those things, but it's going to be harder for a kid with autism because social and communication deficits may get in the way of their understanding what we're trying to do and get in the way of them being flexible enough cognitively and behaviorally to be able to do what I just described.
You have a special autism spectrum disorder program there at Rogers. Talk about what that entails.
Sure. So the first thing that's important to know about that program is we're not treating autism per se. We're treating a secondary anxiety or mood disorder in the context of autism. So the principle there is we've got something else. It could be OCD, it could be social anxiety, it could be depression that is co-occurring with the autism and driving a lot of functional impairment. So those are the kids that we see in that program. When they come in, the way I think about it is it's like a three-legged stool. There's three main places where we intervene. The first is on the anxiety or the depression that's comorbid with this particular kid. So we're going to spend the majority of our time in treatment focusing on that. And we have empirically supported treatments we use for anxiety, for OCD, for depression. We're going to bring those to bear to try to help this kid reduce and eliminate any avoidances and kind of learn to tolerate emotion better. So that's the first thing we're going to do. The second thing we're going to do, because we know we're treating folks who are on the autism spectrum, is we're going to spend some time on social communication and understanding of emotion. Because we feel like the first part of that, the first leg of that stool, is going to go more smoothly in terms of treatment if they understand emotion better, if we teach them why it's important to tolerate, if we develop a vocabulary for them to describe how anxious they are. Because sometimes kids with autism will go 0 to 7. I'm not anxious, and now all of a sudden I'm running out of the room. So we want to teach them to recognize when they're building up, because that's just not what they do. They get avoidant and they leave. So the social communication deficits are the second leg of the stool. Third leg of the stool, and it depends on the kid, in the context of autism, you do see some kids who struggle with activities of daily living, ADLs. And that can get in the way of their success socially, can get in the way of their success at home. Kid doesn't like to shower, kid doesn't brush his teeth, etc. So we may spend – or doesn't know how to make a bed, doesn't know how to use a key, things like that. We may spend some additional program time to help them to be more generally successful and to reduce any sort of peripheral stress that comes around not being able to understand how to do things. There's a nice phrase which I like, which is the lowering tide lowers all boats. So if I can help the kid be more successful and I can help them communicate more effectively and feel more comfortable socially, it's going to be easier for me to do the primary job, which is to treat the anxiety or OCD or depression that is comorbid with their autism that they came in for.
Dr. Martin Franklin, Clinical Director at Rogers Behavioral Health in Philadelphia. For more information about the programs at Rogers for families facing OCD or autism, visit rogersbh.org. Thanks for joining me this morning. You can email the show or browse the archive. Just log on to morefmphilly.com and click on Tell Me More. For 101.1 More FM, I'm Emily Scheibert.